Hey, everybody. We're back. Welcome to High Spirits. It's episode 40, and we're recording Thursday, April 25th, 2024. I'm Ben Larson, and with me, as always, is Anna Rae Grabstein. We have an incredible show for you today. Colin Keeler from Kiva is on, and we're going to be talking about brand expansion from regulated cannabis in California to many other states and hemp and beyond. It's going to be an exciting conversation, a lot of growth happening in the market right now, and we'll dig into all of it. But before we get there, let me check in with Anna Rae. Anna Rae, how are you doing today?
Always good. It was actually great to have a little vacation from recording last week, but I missed you, Ben.
I missed you as well.
But it was a good week. I went to a Bicycle Day event in San Francisco on 419, the Discovery Sessions. And
what kind of bike did you ride?
I did not ride a bike. Bicycle Day is actually a psychedelic holiday celebrating the first acid trip happened when Albert Hoffman was riding his bicycle. So that's why it's called Bicycle Day.
Psychedelic. Is that a dad joke?
No, that's cool. I don't mind it. I saw a Mike Torrey from your team there who was took a PTO day to explore some personal interests. So that was cool. But on the cannabis side, my work this week has been really good. A lot of forward thinking from operators that I'm working with, planning and pivoting in their growth strategies, people talking about raising new rounds for really focused opportunities ahead. Like it is, I'm having fun. It's feeling optimistic and hopeful. And I'm excited also to learn from our guest today.
That's great.
Yeah, really good. Tell me what's going on with you.
Well, I just want to note that it's April 25th. And I believe when we first kicked off the year, I was telling you that I was feeling hopeful and optimistic and that it felt like for the first time, this might be the theme of the year. So happy to hear that you're still feeling that way. I also am feeling that way. Despite being completely burnt out last week, it was all from like a good place. Like at the Benzinga conference, I think spirits seemed generally very high. You know, there was mixed reviews coming out of it. You know, I think I read Mitchell Osok's takeaway and he's like, don't expect any like policy change this year. And MSOs, what are you going to do if that happens? And so that was kind of like the negative aspect. The positive from my lens was that, you know, I asked a lot of fund managers who do seem to be having funds these days what their near-term thesis is. And a lot of it was beverage and Europe. So I don't mind the beverage category taking 50% of the mind share of people managing hundreds of millions of dollars. So that was a very positive outcome of the week. Not to mention just being able to see all the different leaders in the space, not all of them, but many of them. In just a beautiful location. The weather was beautiful this year. Yeah, I just came out of it tired, but excited.
Yeah, and good call out about predictions at the beginning of the year. I think a lot of folks have thought that there was going to be some big announcements about policy change that happened on 420. doesn't seem like that happened.
I don't think the DEA is fans of 420. That seemed a little bit of a pipe dream.
You know, we saw, I think, some rose-colored window dressing type tweets from people like our president and vice president, but not a lot of action. So I think the cannabis industry had an overall pretty decent 420. I've looked at some numbers up in some states, down in others. You know, these cannabis holidays for me, my big concern is always that you get a bunch of increased spending on one or two days, but then that ends up being a decrease of the following month because consumers load up.
Increased spending for anyone that wasn't on the Dutchy platform, sounds like.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Let's not talk about technology platforms today. if anyone wants to hear about POS failures, they can go on LinkedIn and
read about it. That was like all I read for 2 days. Is like, oh, shit, that was bad.
Yeah, enough already. I think that today's topic about expansion is really top of mind for really any cannabis company, because one of the wild things about regulated cannabis, at least in the medical and the adult use space, is that every state is like its own country. It's its own market. It's its own regulatory environment. And as a result, when a company is looking at expanding their market share, they're doing so in a very different way than we might see if you are, you know, a salad dressing company or a t-shirt company that is able to have broad interstate and even like global reach with a lot more simplicity. Mm-hmm. And so expansion strategies in cannabis have become something that is really important for companies that are trying to grow, but also something that is highly complicated. And one of the companies that anyone who's been watching the industry for a long time has most likely admired in their approach to this has been Kiva. Mm-hmm. You know, Kiva is one of the largest and most recognized and longest standing house of brands in cannabis. And at this point, they're in over 12 states and have recently launched their hemp direct-to-consumer platform. So it's a great opportunity for us to get to bring someone on today to learn about how Kiva is looking at this. So with that, I want to invite Colin Keeler, head of business development, onto the podcast today. Hey, Colin.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Good. I'm just going to tell the audience a little about you. You have the role of head of business development at Kiva. Prior to joining Kiva, you were at Atai Life Sciences, which is a publicly traded psychedelic company. You've got a long history of both investing and working in cannabis and healthcare. And you are a graduate of Notre Dame and of Wharton School of Business. So super smart guy, super excited to have you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Exciting.
Yeah.
Long time listener, first time caller, as they say. You
know?
So
I love it.
Well, long time consumer of Kiva chocolates. What? Quick anecdote. I remember my wife and I. It was my earlier days in cannabis, like 2015, and we got one of those beautiful, you know, craft wrap chocolate bars, and I snuck it into my carry on bag, and we flew off to Hawaii, and we were meeting my family out there, and you know, I hadn't really like dialed in my dosing yet. And I remember I cracked one of the squares in half and gave, you know, some of it to my wife and some of myself. And we were waiting for my family to arrive. And by the time they arrived, we were having the best giggle fest, like on a beach and like trying to give my family directions of where to come pick us up. And like, it was still like one of the best memories of our lives. Or, One of the positive stories of getting accidentally a little too high, but just excellent. Ever since then, Kiva has just had a special place in our hearts, and I've loved seeing the evolution of the brand because I do remember, you know, we worked with a lot of startups in the space, and it's like, okay, it's good chocolate, you know, beautiful branding, and you guys were kind of the hallmark of what the future of cannabis looked like just this beautiful packaging, beautiful product. It's like, how do you continue to grow that beyond just that? And seeing what you guys, like the Lost Farm line with like just like the true to the plant ingredients and like partnering with different farms. Like, you know, we had Sonoma Hills Farm on Joyce last week or 2 weeks ago. And just like how you kind of continue to grow going multi-state, which was, again, you know, just in the evolution of cannabis, you know, trying to go beyond state borders was a big deal. Like 12 states, that's a huge deal. And now hemp. So kudos to you guys for just continuing to push the envelope.
I appreciate it. I love stories like that. It's the, you know, talking to folks from different states that, you know, when we're trying to grow into new places, like it's just a constant theme of Kiva was the first, you know, edible product I tried when I visited California, or, you know, I've loved your Terabytes or your Camino gummies. I mean, it's sort of a thing that's sort of consistently here, which obviously I love because it makes my job a little bit easier when I'm trying to expand into new states, but B, reflects the brand that Scott and Christy, our founders, have built from day one, you know, delivering quality products across different categories. So it's each story is a little different, but they're all pretty special when you hear them.
So, Colin, I think you have one of the coolest jobs in cannabis, getting to focus on expansion specifically for one of the hottest brands in the space. Like, tell us what it means to be leading expansion and how you see the space? What does that look like in your day to day?
Yeah. So I mean, traditionally it's challenging, right? I mean, the MSO model sort of represents the fragmentation and how hard it can be to expand because you have to rebuild everything on a state-by-state basis. Like that's the fundamental anti-scale you face with a cannabis brand is you can't go across state lines. Like it's truly, as you alluded to earlier, it's similar to going to different countries. So the good news is that's occurred before. You have, you know, different brands have scaled to different countries before, successfully or unsuccessfully. So there are historical models of expansion that, you know, we've either recreated by accident or, you know, ingested. But for us, you know, we look at our initial expansion of Kiva was under my predecessor, you know, was a licensing model. That was the way you initially did it. If you weren't going to go and buy licenses and assets, you'd find partners who were willing to take your brand under their MSO as multi-state operator. So we are not a multi-state operator in the traditional sense. We're a multi-state brand because we only have infrastructure and manufacturing assets in California. We're the largest edibles brand in California. We have our own manufacturing there, and we're also happen to have the largest full service distributor there as well. So that's where we started. That's our core. And then from there, we've licensed in with other, you know, partners who have, you know, the right to operate in different states. The initial model again was working with them, teaching them the brand, giving them the assets, the packaging, et cetera, and letting them include that as part of their wholesale portfolio. But the models have evolved. And today what we do is try to goal seek against our objective, which is to be the number one edible brand in any state we go into or country or geography of any sort, and do that as, you know, effectively and profitably as possible with for us and our partners. So we're doing a variety of models across different states that we think match the markets as they exist. So it's fun. You nailed it. I'm very happy and fortunate to have this job because it is a lot of strategic thinking. It is a lot of talking to as many people as possible. And then it's going and trying and structuring and execute the deals to grow the pie for us and the people we get to work with. So that's fun.
So you mentioned kind of evaluating each marketplace as you're going into it. And maybe this kind of influences the question that started popping up in my head is, do you have like kind of, because you have so many products and product lines or brands, is there a suite of products that you prioritize kind of launching a new market with? And I guess the extension of that question for me, again, going back to like Lost Farms, where you have these kind of more nuanced products that are, I guess, more regional specific when it comes like to various cultivars and whatnot. Like, yeah, how do you think about that when you're entering a specific market?
No, it's a good question. For every market that we're looking at, we're trying to, in an ideal world, we're bringing our full portfolio because we think it adds value. The more things you have to sell, the more ways you can serve customers' needs. And each of these, you know, each of our products, whether it's gummies or mints or chocolates, or we have our Starburst style chews that's only in California today, but we're going to be bringing out to a number of states this year and into next year. You know, we think those are additive to the whole value proposition to a potential partner, right? But you're totally right that's there's CapEx, there's manufacturing complexity. So of course there's an order of operations in how we like to bring things into market and grow and expand, keep the growth going for us and partners by bringing those things in over time, bringing the best in class innovation that we have in California over into geographies bit by bit. But for some states, yeah, it may not make sense to have a full chocolate suite if it's super duper hot. Right. Or maybe or just, you know, bring the best and sort of the best in class SKUs of that line, as opposed to every innovation we might do. So it's a conversation with partners who know the market best and know their consumers best. And then thinking through how we adjust what we know is successful and a beloved consumer product if we need to.
And so within the context of growth into new states, you talked about how in California, you are a full-scale operator, you control your manufacturing and your distribution. Why not do that in other places as one of the options for expansion?
first use opportunity, right? Like this is, these are licensed markets that sort of dictate what you can and can't do. So the, when we're looking at this, again, I mentioned our objective. I think any brand who's thinking about expansion needs to start first with why they're doing what they're doing. Really understand that. Because a lot of people, brands do things mm-hmm. without thinking about it. Like, well, we should be doing this because we've always done it. That doesn't necessarily make sense. Know your capabilities and what drives your right to win and what drives your success, and then optimize against that, right? So for us, we think we understand like the three things that need to be done in any geography with the product portfolio we have to go and drive into that share position that I mentioned, which is, I want to be number one. If it can't be for structural reasons, then I'll take number, like top three, right? That's our goal when we enter a market. I'm other brands, that's different. Other brands, it might be, hey, I want to enter because this will help build awareness, or I like the ancillary revenue I can do just from letting somebody else do the work, and I'm happy to be just in the market earning some money. That's not, if we're not chasing that shared goal together, then we'll leave a market. We've done that before, right? And that's okay. That's just partnerships like a marriage. You need that alignment from the get-go to chase the things you want together, or nobody will end up happy, right? So,
yeah.
You know, for us, as we look at markets, the jobs to be done from our perspective is, can you, you know, do you have the resources, people, space, expertise to make product to meet unconstrained demand? And can you sell and market effectively against that, right? Those are all jobs to be done. And we always participate in at least some of those, even if we're licensing. This isn't Disney for us. We're not just set it and forget it. Good luck. It's, we're always participating on, you know, marketing. We almost always put bodies in the market that we go to support our partners. And then look at, okay, you know, does your sales team optimize for this? Do you want to be doing the selling, or should we be doing that? And that's why we've moved in some, you know, geographies to co-manufacturing. We do what we call hybrid, which is licensing, but with us doing sales. We've looked at subleasing, which some of our competitors do exclusively. None of it's off the table, but it has to match what we think will drive success in a market. And that's dictated by the size, that's dictated by the number of doors, the maturity.
So follow-up question there. On when you're trying to decide what to do in the market, and you have talked to, we've brought up your partners a few times, like navigating how to find the right partner, I think is something that a lot of brands that are looking at expansion are thinking about. And there's what I would call independent operators, which are maybe just only exist in that state that you're looking at. And then there's the multi-state operator that might be able to scale you into multiple markets, but there is upsides and downsides to those relationships as well. And then within that context, some of those operators, whether they're independent or MSOs, might be vertical or might not. And I'd love if you could share with even some examples with the state market of how you've chosen a partner, what makes the right type of partner, and how that might differ across regions or markets that you're looking at.
Yeah, no, it's a phenomenal question. So what I was alluding to in the sort of last question was like the strategy of it, like looking at the market, trying your best to understand structurally what may or may not beget success and why you should be there. And then the second S of my job is sourcing, right? So it's talking to as many people as possible in a given state to actually understand the opportunity set of potential partners versus what I think would drive success. Because I can think that we could, you know, do a co-man and be the most successful in a given market. If nobody's willing to do that with us, then you can't contemplate that. Right. So you have to go out and meet all these folks. Mm-hmm. The trade-offs are meaningful between different partners. Again, I think it's really identifying what you're asking to be done from each other, right? Like that you have to go in with a shared expectation of the jobs to be done and the trade-offs in terms of a royalty or the economic split or otherwise. So, you know, for us as, for example, like we're launching New Jersey very imminently, right? And we're working with phenomenal operator we knew from California, Erin Gore, the Garden Society. She understands the co-manufacturing model. She's been doing it for the largest brands in California for a long period of time. She didn't have an operation set up at the point we began discussions, but like the confidence of knowing what she'd done in California, what she'd done in Ohio, builds confidence in her ability to execute on that co-manufacturing in New Jersey, right? And we're super excited about that relationship because in terms of the jobs to be done, like, she's going to do it, right? And that's a market mm-hmm. where we feel we feel that we can sell our brand best. There isn't some incumbency advantage or portfolio benefit where being part of another sales portfolio might be better, right? Because sometimes you want to be sitting next to, take Ohio, for example, where we work with Clutch, like unbelievable operators as well. That's a licensing deal. They're doing the selling and they do that really well because Kiva fits their portfolio to a T, right? Like we fill a gap in edibles. We always fill a gap in sort of like a premium, well-known brand that can even complement folks that have their own edibles, but it's great when we're the only edible, right? But they have flower, which was really an important part of that market. So selling both next to each other creates, again, more ways to serve customers. So those kind of, you don't know those things always, but the things I would say for brands that are contemplating this is like, how do you build into the right kind of partner conversations is like, go and do one state well. Like you have to go and demonstrate the value of your brand to somebody. And that becomes a reference point that cascades into other states. Because like just winning in your own state under your own operations doesn't necessarily prove to somebody the reasons that you should work with them. Because especially in new markets, like, well, I can do it all. I can build all my own mm-hmm. brands. I don't need anybody else. Like I've seen this in a few states, you know, more recently. And that's true for a while because what's on shelves will sell. But as markets mature and brands do enter, the value of assortment, whether in a wholesale portfolio or in retail, becomes really important. So like those are the expansion stuff does not start overnight, but it does compound. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the challenges, as we all know, in cannabis has largely been marketing. But the appeal of being a multi-state brand is having some economies of scale in your branding and marketing. And I'm curious as to how that's evolved over time for you guys and how you think about it. And, you know, are there economies of scale that you guys have built in being able to market the brand across all these different states from kind of, you know, the headquarters while allowing the boots on the ground from an operations and sales perspective kind of, you know, persist underneath it?
To an extent. I wish I could say absolutely, but there's both benefits and anti-scale benefits, right? Like redesigning my packaging for every state, right? Like that is just, it's actually a huge drag. Because like maintaining that brand integrity also can, you know, matching in against a variety of different, wildly different packaging needs drives like, it's challenging. People will experience your brand in one state and that will carry to another state. And the strategies you build in one state can cascade into the next state. And of course, the online presence or more national level marketing, some of the stuff you are allowed to do does slowly start unlocking. And then now with some of the hemp things, there's real ability to engage with consumers on a national level in things that were completely unheard of in the cannabis architecture that should reverberate across the ecosystem that our products are touching. So as all great answers, like yes and no to your question, you know, it depends, I guess, is the answer, but yeah.
Yeah, well, the hemp conversation is interesting. We probably spend, you know, the rest of the hour talking on that. There's a lot of excitement about hemp for economies of scale, especially from a manufacturing standpoint. But as this category evolves, you know, starting to see a lot more fragmentation, you know, serving sizes and packaging limits and all this kind of stuff. And the more fragmented that becomes, it starts to feel a lot like cannabis again. This is a very like nuanced way to kind of segue into that side of the conversation. But you mentioned being in 22 states plus DC with the hemp offering. How has that kind of changed your perspective on everything? And I guess we could start, you know, just a very high level. How was that transition for the brand itself historically being, you know, in regulated cannabis and that just kind of the conversation that exists between hemp and cannabis?
Yeah. I mean, look, it's a great question. My funny anecdote about hemp is I was actually, my in-laws live in Minnesota and 2 years ago, I was up at their cabin in the, you know, 3 hours north of the Twin Cities. And my mother-in-law, she just reaffirmed to me one day, she's like, hey, like, totally respect what you're doing. She's the nicest woman. She's totally respect what you're doing, but please, like, don't bring cannabis into here until, you know, until it legalizes. And then the next day, they did the sort of accidental legalization. I said, hey, Patsy, like, it's legalized now. Like, we're good. So that's when it really entered my radar. I'd been following the Delta 8, Delta 10, some of the more true hemp compounds, right? The original sort of loopholes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it became important to me. And when I came back for Christmas, I saw brands on the boutique store shelves, right? Like sitting at the counter. And I realized this was an entirely new class of trade, right? Or multiple classes of trade that these products never had reached, but we'd always dreamed about them reaching. And for me, that became important just to really explore whether we can, you know, enter in a way that maintained everything that was important to us, like whether or not that's required, but, you know, child resistant packaging and the testing standards we've maintained in cannabis. And even down to, I know this is like somewhat of a controversial, but even down to extracted D9 versus converted, like things like that, to maintain the safety standards and the brand integrity that we could bring over some of our best in class products in a way that it was the same product. Right. And like the education that took like 2 years, I mean, a year and a half, which is a, you know, we could have moved quicker, but for us, it was super important to really try and understand what it was, how we could move into it, and really, again, maintaining what makes us special. Like, again, like, get back to it, like, what makes your company special? Every company is the best and worst of its founders. Our founders care deeply about product. Our products are North Star. So, like, we would always want to maintain and bring over the things that, if there's a new channel to reach and if there's a new store we can sell in, we're going to look at it. But if even it's a dispensary or a bodega in Minnesota, you know, is that the right place for our product to be? Is the fundamental question. Mm-hmm. So it was always super exciting, but for us, it was really a methodical process in making the decision to jump over. Now it's been great. Like, the direct-to-consumer launch has been phenomenal for us. It turns out selling things to your customers, you get to know acutely and with a ton of data and a lot of ability to do a lot of things on the marketing side that I mentioned you can't do in cannabis, like, is effective. And make no mistake, it's also a different consumer than you see or that we've seen in the traditional dispensary market. The mix is different. The demographics are different. They're buying at a price that's substantially more expensive than anything you'd see in most cannabis markets. So, for us, it's just a super exciting way to expand the brand.
I would say that I'm going to just use it. I think the word brave is applicable for what Kiva has done by jumping into this space, because I'm not seeing a lot of the other largest brands in cannabis do this. One of your competitors, Wild, has been on the hemp side for some time, but there are not a lot of brands that I'm seeing go from cannabis into hemp. We're seeing a lot of new brands pop up in hemp, and there's a lot of fear around it for cannabis brands that I talk to, and fears around cannibalizing the existing market that they have or pissing off their customers. And I'm wondering, what are some of those biggest challenges that you guys identified and how you worked through them to get to the place where you felt ready to launch, and specifically how you chose which of those states you were going to launch in and how that relates to your existing geography for your medical and adult use cannabis states, if there's overlap?
Yeah, we don't have meaningful overlap today. That was a decision from our point, because again, these are things we want to figure out methodically. As we think about, look, channel conflict is not a new thing. It's existed across industries. Like, look at wine when they started going direct to consumer. There was uproar within the wholesale layer historically. So, like, this gets back to something I mentioned earlier. Like, none of this is that new. We just don't know history as well as we think we do, right? Like, all these problems have existed in a similar but different format. Like, history doesn't, I forget the phrase, history doesn't whatever, but it rhymes, right? Like, that's sort of what we experience here today. So for us, like, managing our existing business and our existing partners, customers, manufacturers, et cetera, is the first priority. They're the core of who we are and how we've gotten to where we are today. But we'd be foolish not to look at Minnesota, where hemp is part of the adult use architecture. It's part of cannabis. It's not hemp versus cannabis. It's all part of the same program up there. And that's where edibles, you're going to see meaningful edible success, because they're just in other places. So for us, we had to move into hemp, at least in that capacity. And if I can reach consumers in places that are never going to legalize in the foreseeable future, right? Like some of the states in the South that have no real roadmap to a meaningful, you know, traditional regulated cannabis program, but I can reach them with hemp, and those states are performing incredibly on direct to consumer right now. That's important for me as a brand. Like that's something we have to do to reach those consumers and continue to build on the trust and awareness that we've had, because you're right, other people, new entrants will take that opportunity if we don't capitalize. In terms of other brands that aren't moving on it, I don't know. There's a lot, right? You know, like there's more than maybe some haven't been as public about it. For us, being forthright about what we are and aren't doing was the most important, you know, sort of the most important thing. But there's MSOs who've crossed over. Curaleaf is doing it. GTI is doing it. Like there's you know, Stizzy's crossed over.
Yeah.
Jeter, like a lot of the biggest brands are doing it. I would say, you know, one of those names you mentioned may be crossing over pretty soon here, pretty too, if what I hear is correct. So like, I think most people are understanding the opportunity and realizing that there's going to be, have to be conscious conversations with folks about, and I've had those about, I'm not trying to eat or infringe on your business, right? Like I'm priced right now twice as expensive. I'm not in those states, but right now I'm twice as expensive as most states. My product is in most dispensaries in most states, right? Like that is not non-competitive. And my goal is to drive across all channels. So it's not going to be an easy thing to figure out, but you got to embrace the hard things, I think, in order for us all to drive towards success. We're all doing that anyway. We're in cannabis, right?
Absolutely. Mic drop there.
It's been such an interesting conversation lately. And what you were mentioning about being in Minnesota and just seeing a completely different reality compared to that in Colorado where you're sitting, or California where we are. And for me, it's like doing that every day, constantly, like as we engage with people, whether it's online or in person, you know, where they're sitting, what their perspective is, it is exhausting. But the exciting thing that we're experiencing right now is the just very obvious convergence of the hemp and the cannabis marketplace. And there's a lot of hard conversations to be had. I know I've been engaged in a lot of them this very recently. I feel like I'm walking around stepping in hornets' nests on purpose. But it's
you live on both sides, Ben. You do, for sure.
I know. Well, and so do you now too. So congratulations.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think we've mentioned this in an earlier conversation, but like the fundamental thing is that this is intoxicating cannabinoids, right? Full stop, right? And anybody who's like, my way is the best, is probably living or talking their own book, because nothing is perfect about how cannabis is done today. And nothing about hemp is perfect as how it's done today. But there's somewhere in the middle that this probably evolves to over, who knows, decades, or the same way alcohol has over time, into something that makes much more sense, that we all believe it should. But folks who are like, I got to kill hemp. And the folks who are like, oh, screw you, cannabis operators, you're monopolists, you need to come over and do it my way, they're talking their own book, right? And that, to me, that's, I'm disinterested in that. I think we should be dreaming of the way things should be and then chasing
it. I do want to take a moment just to say, like, I heard recently, you hear it, right? It's from the hemp side, some people will say it's like, oh, that's the marijuana industry, you guys are federally illegal, we're doing it the right way. And it's like, it is all one plant, and there wouldn't be an acceptance of intoxicating hemp cannabinoids if the regulated market hadn't done so much work to become socially acceptable. And I could argue the exact same from the other side. So it's like we all need to like come to center a little bit more. And I want to give a shout out to David Valancourt because I saw him say recently, can we finally just start talking about cannabinoids instead of hemp versus cannabis? And I'm just super excited for us to get to that place. And I don't know if we're ready today, but 6 months, 12 months, hopefully this activity really helps with that convergence.
I hope so too. But
I love, you know, in almost all 12, in almost, I think all 12 step programs, the first step is to get out of denial and accept what is happening in reality. And I think that in the cannabis side, that is what is needed for those that are really pushing up against what's happening in hemp, is that we just need to accept what's going on here and get out of denial that it's going away and figure out how to make it manageable. And I think within the manageable category, there's a ton of opportunity. And it's not just about financial opportunity. It's also what you mentioned earlier, Colin, about direct communication with consumers, different access to marketing pathways. And there's a lot to be learned there. It's a fun time to be navigating complexities. I want to hear a little bit about the supply chain that you guys are managing on the hemp side, in that you've been talking about DTC. As Ben and I have talked to other hemp operators, people are looking at DTC, but they're also looking at a ground game with wholesale. And a lot of folks on the beverage side are using traditional and existing beverage distributors. Are you guys looking at wholesale on the hemp side? And are you thinking about beverage distribution or other pathways? What's the best way for wholesale to roll out in hemp at a time when it's kind of a greenfield of what it becomes?
Yeah, no, this is a great question. I'd say it's a multi-million dollar question. So we are launching Minnesota wholesale here shortly. We have made our first hire there. We are in conversation with different partners in Minnesota, and we would selectively look at other geographies, again, targeting those states that the biggest opportunity, places we couldn't reach otherwise, et cetera. Beverage is easy. And as it stands right now, it's not perfect, but a beer distributor sort of understands a can, right? They're doing edibles to an extent. We found some that we think are really invested and understand the opportunity edibles represent within that, but they're not going to be optimized for every class of trade. Because we're not, the big thing here, the big paradigm shift is there are the types of customers you're dealing with, the expectations. The one thing that's nice about cannabis is that within dispensaries, there's different types, but generally speaking, you know, most are going to keystone, you know, most are going to be thinking about things in a similar way, you know, how bud tenders will operate. This is going to be fundamentally different across different classes of trade. Convenience, hemp dispensaries, true smoke shops, liquor stores, grocery stores, like there's a ton of different points of distribution, right? And some brands are going to succeed in some of those and less so in others, right? The best brands will succeed in all over time. But even so, if you look at Monster versus Red Bull and compare like on-prem versus convenience versus grocery store, you're going to see meaningfully different patterns for them on how they go to market and how they succeed. So there's no given answer. I think there's actually opportunity for folks to create help on the distribution side or help on the broker side in terms of meeting customers and solving these kind of problems. It's an unsolved problem at this point because it is really novel, but we're building that out now. We're going to have some direct level of sales where we can fulfill directly with customers. We're going to be working with distributor partners that make sense in getting into those kind of endpoints of sale that matter most for us. But it is not as straightforward as cannabis. And I don't think cannabis is super straightforward on the go-to-market either.
Follow up on that, within the hemp distribution, it's been easy to see how you can switch out a can for a can. And so it's clear where those products belong on the shelf. And so it's been easy for Total Wine to create that end cap, or for a liquor store to put a shelf in their cooler to have the hemp beverages. I think on the on the non-inhalable hemp edibles, like what Kiva is bringing to market, I've been a little bit more cloudy over where do those belong on a shelf in, because I'm used to it at a dispensary. And so when you're in a more traditional retail environment, be it a grocery store, a liquor store, not a hemp-focused dispensary or a smoke shop, where do edibles go on the shelf? Where do you place them in the store?
It'll depend. I think Minnesota did themselves a disservice with how they constructed the legislation there that dictates edibles behind, you know, in under lock seal and whatever else. And I get that maybe there's some like theft issues or otherwise, but to me that's sort of an imaginary problem. And you're not necessarily, the only reason you see that mirrored in other states is because they're emulating Minnesota, which may happen, right? And in which case the choice is forced. It's got to sit at the counter in some capacity where it is under lock or behind something in lock and seal for edibles. I don't think it has to be that way. And I don't think it will over time. Do I think it makes a lot of sense in a convenience store for them to be sitting up at the large counters they have where they're already merchandising tons of products that shouldn't be in reach of children and otherwise? Sure. But I think that's something that'll be sorted over time. I don't think the Minnesota model there is perfect. And I think you can create space. I'm not particularly worried about people, you know, jacking like six bags of gummies and running off in a liquor store.
I think the most important part actually is just effective age gating. And it's interesting, you know, I was in Hawaii and was at this grocery store, and I saw some hemp D9 gummies there. And I just grabbed a pack, threw it in my basket, took the basket to the checkout, and it just got rung right through, like really quickly by the checker. And the register, you know, like if you do that with alcohol, the register will like pop up a notice, so say check ID, and like you can't go on until you punch in a birthday. Like that didn't even happen with that product, but it seems like a super easy thing to implement with these products. So there just needs to be some sort of, I don't know, step education that's happening between the distributor and the brands and the retailer, just to implement that one little simple step of like, you know, stop the process, ask for an ID.
And they were in Minnesota before they put the rules as they are today, when they first sort of accidentally legalized, like there wasn't this behind lock and seal for edibles. No, it was sort of Wild West for that first, you know, first year. And when I went to the Patina, which is a boutique up there, like it was at the counter, but it was in front next to all the other candies. But did they know to ask me for my ID when I bought one? For sure. Right. That was already sort of imbued. Totally agree. I mean, I get back to the regulatory side of cannabis. We got to take some of the best of that. And one of the best things that occurred, I think it was the California ecosystem, was they did a sting into dispensaries where they sent kids in trying to buy products underage. You know how many kids got product? Zero.
Yeah.
Zero.
Yeah. Zero.
You do that with a liquor store. I can tell you from when I was a teenager, like that's not the case. Like you can, was that, I mean, like, I'm not saying that that's a pretty high standard, and we want to try and reach for that as much as possible. As we get into more places that won't necessarily be as, because again, most dispensaries are like Fort Knox, right? But I do think that that's something that remains critical for the success of this industry. And anybody, this really grinds my gears, anybody who is fighting legislation on child-resistant packaging, anybody who is fighting ID checks or age, you know, age requirements on intoxicating products is should not be in this industry. Full stop. Like that is super important. And if you were just self-interested, I have no tolerance for that. Full stop.
Well, so zooming out a bit as we're getting close to the towards the last quarter of the hour, what do you think are the hottest state markets? And you can talk about both cannabis and hemp, you know, whatever you want to see like today. What are the markets that you like the best? And then I want to hear about what you're excited about for the next 18 months and the ones you're watching.
Yeah. I'm from outside Philly originally. So the Northeast has been really exciting for me. You know, we're number one in Massachusetts. We're number one or number two in New York. We're launching New Jersey. Not really part of the Northeast, but it's pretty close. Ohio, we're sitting at number one. So clearly the brand has resonance across the Northeast. So for me, effectively building the strategy to maintain that momentum across the Northeast, which remains super important from a cultural perspective. I think New York is inflecting. I think it's the troubles will come to an end at a certain point, and we're going to see that market really attain the potential that it deserves. New Jersey is silently crushing it and just desperately wants more products. So again, super excited to launch there in a few weeks. And I think Pennsylvania, everybody knows this, right? When Pennsylvania flips into adult use, that's going to be a colossal market. It's already a colossal market. And their edible sales are phenomenal, even though they don't really permit edibles. So there's a ton of opportunity there. Within hemp, I'm probably going to move to Minnesota at some point, family, et cetera. Hope we get that one going great. And Texas looks just like that is obviously just has done really interesting things. They're still figuring out. There's a ton of brands doing huge things down there. So I think that'll be a hotbed for the same way California is a cradle of innovation for cannabis in so many ways. Like, I think you're going to see that similar phenomena out of Texas in terms of some of the most successful brands that build there will probably carry into a broader national market. Like, I'm looking there at future competitors, make no mistake.
I'm curious if the California branding for you guys, like the being born out of the California market, how that might influence your brand or your success, or is it beyond that now? I'm just curious.
I think when I say cradle of innovation, I think as a freer market, as one where you've had to learn through every hard lesson and it's a truly competitive market, right? There's no shortage of brands mm-hmm. in California that it hones the knife, right? So less than being like, look, we came from California, which of course is part of our heritage, but more so building a brand effectively in a truly competitive environment, I think has knock-on mm-hmm. benefits, right?
Yep.
The OG status is, Scott and Christy doing this for over a decade, like, of course, is a huge part of it. But within that, it's just all the lessons learned and trust built over that time.
Yeah. Speaking of Scott and Christy, just seeing the journey has been really incredible. Seeing the early, investor pitches and being, just beautiful cannabis to now being such a force in the industry. And I had no idea that you guys were, I knew you were expanding to different markets, but just really being at the top of the heap in so many critical markets, it's a huge, huge kudos to the team.
They built something special, no question.
Yeah. I mean, to Anna Ray's point, any predictions that you have for the next, 18 months as you kind of continue to lean into kind of the hemp and cannabis expansion?
So we're going to get rescheduled. I believe that firmly. I think that it's hard to argue against. I'm not going to prognosticate about specifically when or otherwise, but I don't think that'll be the end of the world. I'm really against this whole mindset that pharma is going to come in. I worked in a biotech before this. We looked at cannabinoids. Schedule 1 is not the reason that cannabinoids were not something we pursued, even as exciting as the potential therapeutic benefits are. And it's not going to upend the state markets we see today. I just think that is people who don't know what they're talking about or are willfully trying to fearmonger. And it's just not, it's going to be a nice tax benefit that people are already taking because they're following the Trulieve strategies. Right. So that's one sort of unrelated thing. Beyond that, I think we see hemp get kicked another year. I don't think that we're going to see any meaningful change come this year. There's too much dysfunction. So that certainly would be nice from a certainty perspective. Although them actually doing something that gives us like clear guidelines to work with between that and cannabis, I think would be even more exciting. I wish I could say that they're just going to legalize, but we all know that that's completely.
I think I'm on board with both of those.
I mean, it's still optimistic that you're calling rescheduling in the next 18 months. So I hope
bring it back down. We'll talk about it. We'll see.
Yeah. And I'm with you on thinking that we're not going to see anything too substantive in the farm bill. I've got some bets going with some other friends in the industry, and basically we're betting avocados, so it's not like super high stakes, but depending.
I don't know, the way those prices can vary, you can make some good money.
It's true.
I don't know if you're on Anna Ray's holiday mailing list, but she has access to the best avocados.
I mean, it's just a local avocado farm, but I do love to send avocados around.
I gotta get on this list. My wife's a huge fan. I love avocados too.
Nice. Well, I'll make sure to get your address. Well, Colin, this has been super fun. I love where you sit in the industry and the perspective that you've been able to share with us today. So I really appreciate it. It's time for our last call. And so this is where we give you an opportunity to leave a lasting impression on our guests. So Colin, what's your last call?
Oh boy, bye Kiva. I don't know. Thank you all for listening, to those that did. And, you know, we're appreciative of the folks who've supported the brand to date and, you know, looking forward to being the edible brand of the country in the future. So.
Big dreams.
Amazing. Well, Colin, thank you so much for joining us and sharing some intel and just being so open. I know a lot of people in the industry have their eyes on Kiva and emulate a lot of what you do. Keep leading the way. Keep fighting the good fight.
Hey, if they want to ever talk, that's my job. Dream of ways we can work together. So give me a call, people.
All right. Yeah, we'll post this contact. Get in touch with Colin. Thanks, Colin. All right, Anna Ray, another one in the bag. And it's good to be back. I'm glad we took the week off. A week felt like a long time. I, you know, after doing this week after week for almost 40 weeks, yeah, I come back refreshed next week. It's just you and me, but we have an exciting announcement. We're finally fulfilling our promise of a little bit of a rebrand. So if we look a little bit different, not us, around us, don't be surprised. Still same old us, still same conversations. But until then, we're wrapping up. So remember, dialogue doesn't have to end here. And we invite you to continue these conversations, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Who would you like to see on the show? What topics would you like to have us cover? We're immensely grateful for you. Your engagement encourages us to keep bringing you these thought-provoking conversations. So if you've enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, and share High Spirits with your colleagues, your friends, heck, your family. Thank you to our teams at Virtosa and Wolfmeyer for your continuous support in our spirited journey. Yeah, we couldn't do it without you guys. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and most importantly, keep your spirits high. That's the show.